JCPOA first and lift all sanctions. Iran would then follow after verification. Iran's foreign minister also talked about this, as seen here, which is identical to Araghchi's blueprint that was presented.
Time to bring in our first featured guest of the show. We have the pleasure of having Ali Rezvanpour. He's a political analyst and an analyst of the Caucasus Affairs at the Expediency Discernment Council. Mr. Rezvanpour, welcome to this program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. My first question to you is a referral back to the previous JCPOA. Now, once that deal was enacted, Iran, according to reports, didn't reap the benefits of what it was entitled to under that agreement. Companies were afraid to do business with Iran because of sanctions that may have been incurred on them, and also on the issue of human rights. They just didn't want to get into making deals with Iran. Was that the case, and will this time around, will those types of problems be alleviated?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Thank you very much. I would like to state that, you know, by taking part in JCPOA meeting right now, which is being held in different parts of sessions in Vienna, one of the most important issues, which is the concern of our Iranian people, our supreme leader, is that we should be very cautious about the process, about the space of the negotiations, about the content of the negotiations. We should be careful and not just giving the permission to the negotiators, I mean the 4+1 or also 5+1, to drag the negotiations. If they wanted to drag the negotiations, we should once and for all just retreat from that meeting and then insist on our own demands. As you mentioned about the sanctions, about human rights, about secondary sanctions, preliminary sanctions, the Western side, the 5+1 group are not trustable, all of them, because once the JCPOA was concluded, you know, after a couple of months, they imposed again some sanctions, which we were supposed to just, you know, be relieved from those crippling sanctions. So in this process, Iranian negotiators should be careful about insisting on their own demands by just referring to our supreme leader statements that the Western side is not trustable. And after that, just try not to give the permission to the Western side to drag the negotiations. Otherwise, we won't get any benefit from those meetings. You know, our supreme leader is very clever regarding political issues. He says that, you know, the American side is trying to impose some suggestions which are disdainful, which are harmful to the Iranian benefits. That's why we do not, you know, just have any confidence in their statements, in their suggestions. By keeping the self-interest, your opposite side is insisting on one principle. What is mine is mine. What is yours is negotiable. This is a principle of international relationships. Those countries who are taking part in different kinds of negotiations with Iranian side are insisting on Iran to just take back different kinds of steps in which Iran has taken by just reneging on its own promises, the U.S. government just triggered Iran to take some steps in violation of JCPOA.
Very well. Thank you very much. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're listening to the statements here made by Mr. Rezvanpour, a political analyst and an analyst of Caucasus Affairs at the Expediency Discernment Council. Thank you for your statements.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Okay, so we heard our guests there talk about some of the different aspects of these stocks, especially at the end. Stay with us. However, we're going to be right back after a quick break. Hello, welcome back. This is our in-depth section. Back in 2015, when the JCPOA was signed and hailed as a landmark agreement between Iran and the world powers, Iran was supposed to gain the economical benefits of this agreement. Yet many U.S. business restrictions actually remained. And that's on top of the U.S. scaremongering of countries and their businesses which wanted to engage with Iran. Now, the U.S. and other countries agreed to lift the economic embargo in 2012 in an effort to curb Iran's civilian nuclear program. Now, the move meant that companies in Europe, in Asia, and elsewhere were free to invest in Iran and trade with Iran, and many were interested in doing so in droves.
همکاری با اقتصاد ایران
Cooperating with Iran's economy is itself an advantage. In this competition, anyone who enters Iran's economy faster will naturally benefit more than the other foreign companies.
This is a true demonstration of the will to try and do and go back to business in Iran.
We are looking forward to come back and to assist in any way we can the Iranians in the oil and gas as well as many other industries.
If the conditions are required, that we can see a flow of investments in various sectors.
But while the U.S. government agreed to lift the nuclear sanctions against Iran, it imposed other sanctions, like over Iran's alleged human rights violations or alleged support for terrorism. These sanctions barred American citizens and companies from most forms of investment or trade with the country. In theory, those sanctions should affect only U.S. companies, but in reality, the law's reach goes well beyond U.S. borders. For example, U.S. financial sanctions still caused problems and made European businesses and banks subject to U.S. economic punishments. This is how much trade should have happened between the EU and Iran.
First, on the economic sector, we have agreed to enhance our economic cooperation. We will support the Iranians' bid to join the WTO. We have agreed to exchange business delegations and to cooperate on financial issues, on tourism, textiles, agriculture. And we used to be an Iranian main trade partner, and we are determined to take up that position again.
You see how much it covered there? I mean, that's back in 2015 when the JCPOA actually happened. Well, the U.S. wasn't going to have any of that. Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin actually threatened EU countries from doing business with Iran.
Let me first comment on Instex. I don't believe there's been any Instex transactions. As we've made clear, we are working on a Swiss channel that we have approved for humanitarian transactions. We'll continue to allow humanitarian transactions. We've warned Instex and others that they will most likely be subject to secondary sanctions depending on how they use that.
Yeah, secondary sanctions. I'm sure that's going to probably pass over. Now, do you want to get an idea about the types of contracts that didn't happen as a result of the U.S. scaremongering, like you just heard there, and threats? Let's take a look at some of them. Germany Siemens, $1.6 billion. You got that technology firm to have signed that. Boeing airplanes, remember? $3 billion that Iran signed for all those airplanes. I think there were 100 of them. South Korea oil and gas, $1.8 billion. Total Petroleum from France, $4.8 billion. I could talk about 20 or 30 contracts. Well over $100 billion could have been done in sales, potential revenues, but they were lost in that year when these were signed. And after the JCPOA was signed, these, again, to have been actual agreements, MOUs, and also sales to have happened. Well, the U.S. threats, like former U.S. Treasury Secretary, was basic scaremongering. If you were a businessman, how would you react to it? Well, here's one reaction that speaks volumes.
We must be confident in the future while we know that sanctions are still there and the relief is very limited.
Notice the skepticism there? Now, this is back when the JCPOA was signed. So how would a country invest in Iran when that type of pressure was being exerted? Well, let's bring in a guest to make sense out of some of this. Scott Ritter, he was a former weapons inspector in Iraq, where he ran intelligence operations for the United Nations from 1991 to 1998 as a weapons inspector. The U.S. Treasury Department is what we're going to ask from him about how they exerted themselves. Scott Ritter, welcome. You have the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Financial Assets Control, which made it clear that no payments linked to Iran is going to actually get processed through the U.S. financial system. This is when the JCPOA was signed. So if you receive money from Iran, for example, as a bank or company, you must make sure that this money does not then go to the U.S. or to a U.S. bank or to any U.S. subsidiary. But most international companies actually go through the U.S. So how can the JCPOA even be a deal?
The U.S. has always used the SWIFT code, the banking system, as a mechanism of controlling global economics to put pressure on countries to do the bidding of the United States through the threat of secondary sanctions. That is, if a country, for instance, if the United States sanctions Iran and says you can't do business with Iran, Any European country or Asian country that does business in Iran and uses the SWIFT system will be subject to secondary sanctions. This has always been one of the powerful tools that the United States Department of Treasury had, and it's clear that the Biden administration, as much as they say they want to rejoin the JCPOA, they don't really mean it, because if they meant it, the Department of Treasury, which works for the President of the United States, by the way, could be told not to enforce these. New instructions could be written.
Okay, you heard it there from Scott Ritter there explaining that to us. We appreciate that from Scott. And finally, all of this brings us to the current Vienna talks, a repeat scenario in the sense that the U.S. is not lifting all the sanctions, while it is also after dividing the sanctions and in some cases relabeling them. Well, this is what the lead negotiator of the talks from the Iranian side has said about sanctions, in which he said, we have to go back to the same model of the JCPOA.
No, we have to go back to the same model in the JCPOA. They are sanctions which should be terminated, and the U.S. president has the authority to terminate them, so that they should be obviously terminated through executive orders. And there are sanctions which are actually the result of the Congress, legislation. For them, the president could only waive, and this has been mentioned in the JCPOA. So we want all those sanctions be reversed. Whatever imposed during this Trump administration, whatever imposed or reimposed or relabeled during Trump administration, and whatever is mentioned in the JCPOA should be lifted, and they should reverse whatever has been done. And I think the Americans know best how to do that.
Full of business opportunities, an investor's paradise. From the population, which is market-oriented, to natural resources, and to its transport capabilities. Here are a couple of snapshots of Iran's untapped potentials, from sea boundaries to roads, railway networks, and commercial ports. Then comes the natural resources. Agricultural products and crude oil ranking fourth in the world, to natural gas reserves coming in at number two. But the U.S. sanctions regime has bit into Iran's revenues and investors who can profit from it. Iran's GDP growth to have dipped in the negative territory, as seen here for the years 2018, 19, and 2020. Iran's auto sector, for example, has been hit hard. Production to have fallen from around 2 million units to half, around 1 million units.
In 2014, the fear that the United States instilled within the global community regarding the potential backlash financially for doing business in Iran prohibited many European businesses from engaging with Iran after the signing of the JCPOA. And so this is why it's absolutely critical that all sanctions are lifted, not that they are categorized, and certainly that those that were reimposed and or were relabeled are lifted.
Okay, in this segment, I would like to welcome Masoud Barati. He is the administrator of the Iranian Think Tank Network, and he has a lot that he wants to say about the talks in Vienna and the JCPOA deal, especially the whole notion of sanctions. Okay, welcome to this program. Thank you for taking the time to come here. My first question to you, give us your feedback on what you think about the talks so far.
My greeting to you also. I'm glad to be here. The talks in Vienna are being conducted within the confines of the U.S. returning back to the agreement. But U.S.'s return to the deal, from Iran's point of view, is for the U.S. to eliminate all the sanctions. In my opinion, there was no need for talks if the issue at hand was solely for the U.S. to return to the deal.
Let's take a quick timeout, listen to Mr. Araghchi, his explanation of what sanctions are all about, and then we'll come back to you to get your reaction on that. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Okay. What do you think about what he has said?
The point that Mr. Araghchi is making at the beginning contradicts his ending statement and does not match what he said at the end. When we talk about a step-by-step approach, these opposes the official line and stance by the Islamic Republic when it comes to the nuclear attacks. It may appear that the U.S. on the surface may be moving towards sanctions relief, but we had the experience from the previous agreement when there was an agreement with the P5+1. Although the agreement was the first with the U.S. did all that it could to keep the sanctions and even expand them. It penalized major banks like French bank that it fined $9 billion after the agreement. And then the U.S. and Saudi Arabia established the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, in Saudi Arabia. This was the U.S. Treasury Department's branch for the West Asia region in the beginning of the 2017. This was done when former U.S. President Trump visited Saudi Arabia at that moment. Iran incurred a heavy blow at the end of the year from this organization. This is just one of many examples of how the U.S. not only keeps its sanction structure, but also expands it based on how it sees fit. Even now, during current U.S. President Joe Biden's term, prior to him coming into office, a 50-strong task force specializing in sanctions was set up, consisting of Mr. Cohen and Mr. Nephew and other officials from both parties. This was set up at the U.S. National Security Agency with the aim of developing and expanding sanctions. If we are seeing that the sanctions pressure is not as intense as before, it's not because they are negotiating with us, but it's because of the sanction cycle. Definitely after 1 or 2 years, there will be new sanctions that will be applied or will come about.
Okay, thank you very much. That's some insightful stuff there. We do appreciate your comments, Masoud Barati, Iranian think tank network. He is the administrator of that think tank. Thank you so much for joining us here in Economic Dubai. Okay, lots of good stuff there from our guest, which I'm sure you'll be thinking about. At this point, we are going to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Toughest and most comprehensive multilateral sanctions that the Iranian government has ever faced.
17 specific sanctions against Iran's largest...
It's all about the sanctions with the U.S. when it comes to Iran. The U.S. has sanctioned all that it could, from Iranian officials to industries and even Iran's leader.
An executive order imposing hard-hitting sanctions on the Supreme Leader of Iran and the Office of the Supreme Leader of Iran and many others.
How is that for diplomacy? The U.S. calls it the maximum pressure campaign.
That they will face mounting financial isolation.
But even according to their own officials, it has failed.
It's been many years since the United States has had that kind of...
Take Rob Malley, U.S.'s Iran envoy. He has said that the maximum pressure on Iran has failed, and that a return to the nuclear deal is the first step out of the morass. His suggestion? To offer Tehran a Goldilocks-style deal enough sanctions relief so that Iran will return to the deal, but not so much that it would leave the U.S. President Joe Biden vulnerable to hardliners at home. The U.S. side has said that they have a list of measures on both sides to come back into compliance. The next step is to sequence these to allow both sides to save face.
Iran has been slowly moving away from its JCPOA commitments and coping with the sanctions. In the past months, with Biden having made no progress in lifting the sanctions, Iran has reached 1 million barrels of oil per day in its oil export, and the capital that was blocked in Iraq, South Korea, and Japan, well, it has become more accessible to it. I mean, Iran is getting past that crisis. It's getting past the COVID-19 pandemic by signing contracts for export of its domestically made coronavirus. I'm saying all this to point in the direction that whether or not a deal takes place, and in this program, we've tried to toe the line in the middle by bringing the guests and the viewpoints that we have, that deal or not, Iran is going to move forward. It will progress. So it's time for the West, in particular the U.S., to make its mind up whether it wants to make a deal with Iran or not. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. For me, Kavit Halfway, and the whole team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the Month of Allah. In this segment, we'll be talking about famous Quran reciters in the world of Islam. One of the reciters of the Quran, who's Egyptian, and probably you haven't really heard his name before, is Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qawi. Even me, myself, I hadn't listened to his recitation before, but I listened to one of his recitations, and I really liked his recitation. This reciter, he was born in 1915 in the Sharqiya Governorate of Egypt. Okay, we could say something about Sharqiya Governorate. The style of recitation of different reciters of the Quran is sometimes relevant to the place they are born, the region where they were born and they live. Okay, the Sharqiya Governorate is an eastern governorate of Egypt. The reciters in this region recite the Quran similarly. Okay, for example, Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif was also born in Sharqiya Governorate. His recitation resembles Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi, which we're talking about right now. And Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi was also from the Sharqiya Governorate. Or even those who were not from Sharqiya Governorate, but were close to Sharqiya Governorate, meaning the eastern governorates of Egypt, such as the Qahliya Governorate, such as where reciters such as Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, Sheikh Abdul Samad al-Zanati, and Sheikh Hamd al-Zamil were born and raised and lived there, you will see many similarities among these reciters, because they were in the eastern part of Egypt. Likewise, in the western part of Egypt, you will see the same similarities, between reciters. For example, Mustafa Ismail was in Gharbiya governorate, the western governorate of Egypt. And Ghalwash, Sheikh Raghab Mustafa Ghalwash, was also from the western governorate. Sheikh Muhammad Abdulaziz Hassan was also from the western governorate of Egypt. And these three reciters, they recite the Quran similarly. Their style of recitation is similar. Sheikh Abdul Haq al-Qadi, who was born in 1915, this was at a time when great reciters emerged in Egypt, such as Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, Sheikh Minshawi Abdul Basit, and all the other great reciters. Sheikh Abdul Haq al-Qadi used to recite the Quran along with these reciters in different ceremonies that were held in Egypt, in different parts of the country, and in different mosques. For example, in Lady Zainab Mosque, say the Zainab Mosque, sometimes reciters would go there and recite the Quran for different ceremonies. Or in Masjidul Imam Hussein, Imam Hussein Mosque, they would go there and recite the Quran. Sheikh Abdul Haq al-Ghadi is a very good reciter. This great reciter passed away in the 1990s, and many great reciters recited the Quran in his funeral, such as Sheikh Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al, Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi, and other great reciters. Now with this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to the recitation of Surah Al-Isra, verses 13 to 14, by Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi. Let's listen and enjoy this recitation.
And for every person we have imposed his fate upon his neck, and we will produce for him on the day of resurrection a record which he will encounter spread open. It will be said, read your record. Sufficient is yourself against you this day as accountant.
We are with you. What about you? English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recently, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's office has been accused of backing a report that argued that the United Kingdom is not institutionally racist, which itself has been torn apart by experts and analysts. And Boris Johnson himself, of course, has a long record of having made racist and bigoted comments. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled Boris Johnson's Premiership Total Failure. Ordinary People Pay the Price. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. It seems at times as though everything Boris Johnson touches results in complete shambolic failure. For many living in Britain, this reality is not new, nor is it new to the millions who, interestingly, in spite of his track record, voted for him as London Mayor and ultimately as Prime Minister, fulfilling Johnson's long-held dream of running the country. But Boris Johnson's leadership as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has been nothing short of a complete, unmitigated disaster. And his ascension to the highest office in the land arguably serves as one of the ultimate examples of career opportunism and also duplicity. The latest claims and allegations leveled at Johnson align perfectly with his track record so far. And despite those claims, including the suggestion that Boris Johnson said he'd rather see bodies piled high in their thousands than order a third national lockdown, Johnson, for the time being at least, continues to weather the current political storm. Politics in Britain is in crisis, and Boris Johnson is standing firmly in the middle of the storm. It's no secret to those with an understanding of his career that Boris Johnson always harboured ambitions to be Prime Minister and seemed to be of a mindset from a young age that it was his right, almost destiny, to enter number 10 Downing Street. Boris Johnson's own sister has spoken of how Johnson, as a child, had professed ambitions to supposedly become world king. Perhaps this partly explains why Johnson, despite the carefully crafted image offered to the public, is so dangerous. And dangerous he certainly is. His belief and conviction of his own right to rule at whatever cost to Britain means he might do just about anything to remain in power in the face of all the evidence underscoring the fact that he's simply not fit to serve as Prime Minister. The current shambles of the government reflects this reality, whilst Boris Johnson's own track record proves it. At the time of writing, and not for the first time, Boris Johnson is trending on social media, with many calling on him and demanding he leave office. The current state of affairs in Westminster and around the country was predictable, certainly when considering the past. Boris Johnson failed as a journalist. To be precise, he was sacked in 1988, for fabricating claims made in an article. He was sacked as a shadow minister in 2004 over charges about inappropriate affair in his private life. But as London Mayor, and after a few stints as a pundit on television, Johnson was able to revitalize his image and use his platform as Mayor of London to endear himself to many in the public. His subsequent rise to become Prime Minister and his time in office since have been no different. Boris Johnson staked his prime ministerial campaign run on being an outspoken proponent of the Leave campaign in the run-up to Brexit, regardless of the revelations indicating he had no real serious ideological commitment to either position. As Prime Minister, Johnson then made the entire general election, in which he was eventually victorious, about Brexit, pledging to get Brexit done successfully, persuading many communities who may yet prove the hardest hit by Brexit to vote for him. Whilst in office, Johnson famously prorogued government in order to push through his widely criticised no-deal Brexit plans, a move which was later ruled as unlawful by the Supreme Court. And again in office, Boris Johnson was hit with claims of yet another improper affair in his own personal life. Recently, Johnson's office has also been accused of backing a report that argued that the United Kingdom is not institutionally racist, which itself has been torn apart by experts and analysts alike. And Johnson himself, of course, has a long record of having made racist and bigoted comments. Sadly, the problems characterizing the leadership of Boris Johnson seem endless, and all, of course, arise amid a backdrop of other very real problems. While Britain attempts to emerge from the grips of a pandemic that threatened and still threatens to cripple the National Health Service, the NHS. In recent days, media reports questioned the means by which Boris Johnson paid for the refurbishment of No. 10 Downing Street may not surprise those with a keen eye on developing political situation in the United Kingdom. But what should not be overstated is the seriousness of the overarching claim that has shocked millions of people. Reports of Johnson allegedly stating that he would rather see bodies piled in their thousands than order a third national lockdown, if true, reaffirm a different kind of shallowness and selfishness. Thousands have already died due to the coronavirus pandemic. Many would argue that countless deaths could have been prevented had Boris Johnson taken serious action and much sooner over the pandemic. Johnson himself contracted COVID-19 and by his own admission was saved by the same NHS, which many now believe is under severe strain due to his decisions and the actions of his party. While in most circumstances the controversy surrounding Boris Johnson might have led another leader in another nation to fall on his own political sword, Johnson survives. But at what cost? Whilst Johnson continues to survive a political storm of his own making, it is not the first time he is clinging on to power, and it symbolizes a so-called democracy and country in deep crisis. Whilst millions of people around the country continue to live in a reality and within circumstances that will simply never be felt by either Boris Johnson himself or his cabinet of privileged millionaires.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, I be. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam alaikum everyone, whoever is listening. We are at Youth Station. This is your host Mehdi, and I have another person with me in this room.
I'm Zainab. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
She happens to be a host.
Ladies
too.
And gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms. You know how we're all going to die one day? Death is the most natural and inevitable process of every living creature. Every living creature has to see it. Now, I actually look forward to death. For those of us who believe in a god or some higher divine entity, not necessarily even a god. Some don't specifically believe in a god, but they still believe in a concept called hereafter or resurrection or reincarnation. Basically, and all of the one thing that all of these processes have in common is that you will face the consequences of your actions. Like, even in resurrection, in this lifetime, if I'm a Zainab and I bullied, like, I oppressed an innocent puppy, right? Some belief system.
Why does it have to be animals with you always? Is this a puppy or a cat?
I love animals so much. Just like you don't know me at all, yo.
Yeah, but still, humans exist, you know. Anyway,
for the belief systems that those doctrines that believe in resurrection, it is said that in the next lifetime, I'll be born as a puppy.
Wow, you wish, don't you?
And someone would come and oppress me, you know, just to get the karma balanced out. Right?
Yeah.
So my question is, it's the belief, it's something that a lot of people believe in, even if they don't believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'd say over 5 billion people believe in some sort of hereafter.
Yeah.
Do you think that makes their life, that their quality of life and the morality of their lives any better?
Depends, because so many of us, when I say us, people who believe in something close to hereafter, is that do we really pay attention, or that do we recall that? Do we remember that? I don't know how to phrase it, that this is going to happen, you know? It's not necessary that if I believe in a hereafter, I do also constantly remember that it's going to happen.
True.
As a result, you know, I mess up.
Exactly. But man is...
What?
I'm bound to mess up. That's not a big deal.
Yeah, what I'm saying is some people might believe that there is a hereafter, and some people might not believe there is a hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And you might observe that those people who do not believe there is a hereafter are at times better in
more
certain places.
Beings, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
So do you think it's not the concept of hereafter that makes people better? It's that moral compass sort of thing?
You know, there's something very subtle that we have to pay attention to here, is that those people who are good human beings, for example, if you asked an atheist, why are you such a good person? If you say, why do you care about right and wrong and stuff like that? They're going to be like, really? So I have to have faith in the hereafter in order to be a good person?
Mm.
If that's your motivation and your... if that's what your morality tells you, because you're questionable and you have to answer for something, you have to be a good person, not for the sake of being a good person itself, then, you know, it's... really weak.
Bogus reasoning,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
I think it all depends on where you're standing. If you're standing on the atheist side, it might make sense that I value being good for the sake of being good. I don't need a higher power reigning over me, controlling me, holding me accountable in order to make the best out of myself, right? And I think that kind of makes sense.
Doesn't
to an
it?
Extent. Yeah, but then there is the problem of criteria for what is good and bad. Do you know what I mean? Certain things are universal, right? Justice, honesty, bravery, kindness, they're all universal concepts of goodness that everyone understands, regardless of their doctrine, their background, their worldview. But then the cases where these concepts should be applied, the extent that they should be applied in, and also other definitions of good and bad, begins to vary and differ and sometimes deviate when you don't have a higher power, a higher divine power that defines it for you, right? And that's why I feel believe in a concept such as hereafter is so important. Yeah. Or just not even hereafter, the concept of consequence. The concept of what goes around comes around. You are held accountable for your actions. Whatever you do, you're going to see the result.
The thing about that is, for example, you are a Muslim.
For example.
Yeah, for example, you're a Muslim. And there are certain Muslims who really would not care about a hereafter in a positive sense.
Then can you still consider,
in a positive sense. They don't care about that. For example, the fact that they live the way they've been told to live by the Lord is enough for them, and they have nothing more to live
because
for.
Because the Lord told them to do so.
That's it. And
that's beautiful,
yeah,
actually.
You know?
Like the way Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam vibed.
Precisely, you know. That is fair enough, right? But the concept of hereafter, me as a Muslim, not just me, like someone as a Muslim who is, well, say, affluent or well off or maybe in the middle class. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. This guy can, even a poor Muslim, but what about those people who are around us and who are suppressed and oppressed, and they were born oppressed and they die oppressed, right?
And?
So if there wasn't a hereafter, those are the people who really would suffer, you know? The hereafter is there for these people not to suffer. Fair enough, they are suffering in this world, but the eternal bliss is probably waiting for them, right?
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
If there wasn't a hereafter,
things would be, I think, in vain. Things would be futile, meaningless, in vain. Not just hereafter, the whole concept of compensation, a realm where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would fully manifest his jabbarness, the compensator, because suffering and struggle would make no longer make any sense.
In depends.
Any sense of the word, in fact.
Is your question or our question the existence of a hereafter
and how it affects our lives,
or is it no hereafter but a god, or is it
no
hereafter?
It's hereafter centric.
No, I mean, is it about the existence of God also? Does it like encompass that? If there is no God and there is no hereafter, then that's a mess and a half. But if there is no hereafter and there is a God, then there are certain people who would still...
Well, what about for those who believe in karma? The Buddhists and the Hindus and some other religions. I know Buddhists and Hindus because I lived with them for a really, really long time. And I might have had like really strong Buddhist inclinations during a period of my life. We don't need to talk about that.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily believe in that higher power that created life and good and bad. Sure, they believe in Buddha, but Buddha isn't their god, quote unquote, per se. He's their guider, right? But at the end of the day, in order to go to nirvana, we all have to go through a whole lot of resurrection and reincarnation to pay off our karma, to compensate if we've done well, if we've done bad.
Yeah.
So no, it doesn't necessarily have to be a god. A lot of atheists even believe in reincarnation.
Was it Imam Khomeini who said that if there was no heaven and praying was not obligated upon you, no one would pray? Was it him who said that?
I'm not sure, but
someone said that.
It was
like
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam who said, "I'd rather be in masjid praying than in heaven."
That's insane.
You know, it's really deep because Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam understood the concept of good and bad and transcended the whole system of if I am not held accountable, that I'm not going to bother being good. You know, he had the best of both worlds. He had that side of really righteous humanity that some atheists do. Come on, we got to give it to them. Some atheists are really, really good people.
Yeah.
They just don't believe in God, right? And that's, you know, you do you.
But there's another thing about these people, though.
No, wait. Back to Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Yeah.
He had the best of both worlds. And then he had that upright, righteous, right, being good for the sake of being good mentality of some atheists. And on the other hand, he was so immersed and annihilated in Tawheed. And he mixed these two together. And he was like, you know what? Even if there's no heaven and hell, I'm going to worship you anyway because you deserve to be worshipped. You're awesome. You're fabulous. You're my God. You know what I mean? I think that's the basically the epitome, the pinnacle of it that we're meant to reach. But for us mere mortals that obviously are not Amir al-Mu'mineen, are related to him, but are not him, sadly. Or actually, it's a good thing, because being Amir al-Mu'mineen comes with a lot of responsibilities. I can't handle that. For us, there has to be, we have to have a concept of accountability and compensation and consequence, because otherwise we forget. I mean, we have it and we still forget. Imagine how whacked up we'd be if we didn't forget. Okay, I'm done. What were you saying?
About these people.
Which people?
Atheists that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of them are really good people and they do not believe in God. And that we might be accountable for that, we as Muslims, because the God that we introduce most of the times is a God that really does not exist, you know? So if these people, for example, people like Stephen Hawking, if they were introduced the proper God that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that the way Allah wants to be known, I wouldn't be surprised if these people became
better Muslims than us. Better believers.
Yeah.
With some of these, they actually do believe in God. These scientists who end up being atheists, or atheists who end up being scientists. I don't know which came first, actually. The egg or the chicken. But they believe in a God. It's just not the God of consequence, again. He's a creator God. He's just not the God of good and bad. And I think it's because the believers of, you know, the God of good and bad.
And that's actually the reality, isn't it?
Because have done such a messed up job at defining what good and bad is. We're going to talk about that on one episode, inshallah. But that's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness and my love.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran, You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.